From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Next Monday marks the 20th anniversary of President Nixon's resignation from office. A five-part documentary series on Watergate begins this Sunday on the Discovery Channel. The narrator is Daniel Schorr, NPR's senior news analyst. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Schorr about his experiences covering Watergate for CBS TV. He became part of the story when he appeared on Nixon's enemies list. Also today, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new reissue by the now-defunct Irish band The Undertones. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen says he's satisfied that his aides acted ethically in the savings and loan case involving President Clinton. Bentsen has told the Senate Banking Committee that Deputy Secretary Roger Altman, a friend of the president, finally made the right decision to remove himself from the case. NPR's Barbara Campbell reports.
Bentsen said he was relieved when Altman told him he would recuse himself from the investigation of Madison Guaranty Savings and Loan. But Banking Committee Chairman Senator Donald Riegel pointed out that Altman first decided not to recuse himself under pressure from the top White House lawyer. Bentsen said the Office of Government Ethics found no wrongdoing in that decision. Riegel asked Bentsen whether that was good enough.
Are you comfortable with that? With the situation I've just described.
They live and work at that, and I'm not going to question their judgment. Mm-hmm.
I've got to tell you, I'm troubled about it.
Republican Senator Alphonse D'Amato told Bentsen that Altman wanted the White House to see him as helping the president by staying on the case. D'Amato said Bentsen should have insisted Altman recuse himself because of Altman's friendship with Mr. Clinton. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
The Federal Reserve has released a new report on the country's economic health. The Fed's so-called Beige Book survey finds there's been a slowdown in business activity. The central bank finds the economy is still growing, but at a slower pace. The report will be used by Fed officials when they meet August 16th. They'll consider whether to boost interest rates for a fifth time this year. The Rwandan government's envoy to the United States is calling on the international community to help convince refugees in Zaire that it's safe to come home. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly has more.
Gerald Kahima says so far his country has been fighting a losing battle, trying to convince refugees to return to Rwanda. He insists that Hutus are not the enemy of his new government and that only those guilty of massacres face punishment upon returning home.
The only solution for the refugee problem in Zaire is for the refugees to come home and to come home very soon. And we've already started making approaches to the refugee community, as I said, through the good offices of the neighboring countries to try to convince them to come back.
Kahima says the international community can help by seeing that their radio broadcasts get through to refugees in Zaire and by disarming troops of the former government who've been living among the refugees and telling them not to return home. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
The Israeli parliament has overwhelmingly approved a new peace agreement ending the state of hostilities with Jordan. The Knesset approved the measure today 91-3 with two abstentions. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 8 points to 3,788. Trading is heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq is down half a point at 724. This is NPR. The Federal Communications Commission has unveiled a plan to prevent consumers from being billed for calls they didn't make to 800-number information services. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The FCC action follows more than 2,000 consumer complaints in the first 6 months of this year. The majority of consumers had problems with calls to adult-oriented services carried on 800 numbers. The agency says the problem involves only a small portion of the information services industry, companies that not only use 800 numbers to deliver services, but also charge for the call. The vast majority of information services use 900 numbers. 800-number services are usually free of charge unless the company, using an exception in a 1992 law, got permission through an agreement with the caller. The law doesn't specify how the agreement had to be constructed, and that's where the problems have arisen. In many cases, the individual caller, who may have agreed to the charge, wasn't the party getting billed. Rather, the home or place of business from where the call was made received the charges because the local telephone company sent the bill there. Under the FCC's new plan, local phone companies have to make sure they're billing the individual caller. They must verify that a written contract has been made between the caller and the information service company before they bill for 800 number calls. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
The Bosnian Serb Assembly is voting today on whether to accept an international peace plan for Bosnia. Bosnian Serb leaders have already rejected it twice. The deal would make the Serbs give up about a third of the Bosnian territory they've conquered and turn it back over to the new Muslim Croat Federation government. The American Heart Association is asking parents to teach their children not to smoke. Dr. Gerald Berenson is a spokesman for the group. He says research shows some smokers light up as early as the third grade. He says teaching children in kindergarten and even earlier will help prevent heart disease. The association is releasing its first scientific study today on smoking and children's health. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Daniel Schorr, NPR's senior news analyst. We've invited him to look back on Watergate and his career in journalism. Monday marks the 20th anniversary of President Nixon's resignation from office. Schorr is the narrator of a documentary series about Watergate that begins this Sunday on the Discovery Channel. Watergate is an important chapter in Dan Schorr's life, not only because he covered the story for CBS TV, but because he was on Nixon's enemies list. Schorr worked for CBS from 1953 to 1976. He was brought there by Edward R. Murrow. He left after a falling out with CBS over the publication of a suppressed House Intelligence Committee report, which had been leaked to Schorr. From 1979 to 85, he was CNN's senior Washington correspondent. I asked Dan Schorr if he learned anything new about Watergate from the documentary series he narrates.
Well, I learned, for example, they'd come up with a document which nobody had found before, everyone thought had been destroyed, in which, in fact, Haldeman, H.R. Haldeman, the chief of staff to President Nixon, had, in fact, specifically authorized the project which ended up in the break-in into Watergate. I learned that President Nixon, who was responsible for the cover-up, but always claimed that he didn't know about Watergate, may not have known about the breaking into Watergate, but that he gave instructions which inevitably led to breaking into Watergate because he said he wanted to target Lawrence O'Brien, the Democratic National Chairman, for reasons which are interesting and we may want to get into later.
Do you think that the gravity of Watergate looks any different now in retrospect than it did to you at the time?
Well, I think people have tended to devalue Watergate by this device of adding the word gate to a lot of other things that have happened since. And, you know, you look back and I can remember something called Korea Gate involving some bribery and corruption of congressmen by South Korea. I can remember something called, at one time, Billy Gate, which had to do with President Carter's brother having represented, without reporting the same, represented Libya and some things, and finally Irangate, Iraqgate, BCCgate, and all kinds of gates. And if you add a certain number of gates in the end, they all seem to become trivial. But when you go back over Watergate, you realize that Watergate was the index against which all other scandals involving the White House have to be measured. And even today, as we watch the Whitewater hearings, and there you get a senator raising the question of what did the president know and when did he know it, which is an echo of Senator Baker during the Watergate hearings. But then you realize that here we don't have any crime, or not any known crime, or not even any known unethical act. We have no villain that we've spotted yet and no real villainy yet. And you measure this against Watergate, and, you know, if it's on a scale of 10, you come up with a 0.1 or 0.2. So I think that it's very important to remember Watergate because it was such a colossal event in this country's history that if you don't go back and remember it, then you're kind of destined to repeat it in one way or another.
Well, Dan Schorr, since this is since we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of Nixon's resignation, and since you're narrating this BBC-produced documentary on Watergate that begins Sunday on the Discovery Channel,
produced for the BBC, just to be absolutely correct,
thank you.
Independent production team.
Good. Well, what I want to do is talk with you a little bit about what your life was like covering Watergate for CBS TV. And I thought we could start with what had to be one of the most dramatic moments of your journalism career. And I'm thinking of when you were reporting live on Nixon's enemies list,
yes,
which I believe you'd just been handed.
Yes.
What happened when you got to enemy number 17?
Well, exactly. I mean, here was John Dean testifying in June 1973 before Senator Ervin's Watergate committee. And in his testimony, he said that at the White House, they had drawn up something called enemies lists, but he didn't read them, so that we waited until the end of the session to get the first copies of what had been submitted in evidence. And there we were outside the Senate caucus room waiting for the hearing to break so that we could get on the air. I say we, Sam Donaldson of ABC and Douglas Kiker, Sam Donaldson of ABC, Douglas Kiker of NBC, and myself, standing more or less shoulder to shoulder and talking into our own cameras, each wanting to be 2 or 3 seconds ahead of the other in revealing whom the Nixon people considered to be enemies. And so the thing was handed to me live on television. And I said, here it is, the first of the enemies list from John Dean. It's headed on screwing our political enemies. And let me kind of read it to you. I see there 20 numbered names. And went down the list and came indeed, as you suggested, to number 17, where it said, Daniel Schorr, a real media enemy. And I kind of gulped and went right down to the next name and down to the last name, which was Mary McGrory, and said, now back to you, trying as hard as I could to pretend that my name belonged to somebody else because I had suddenly been dragged into the story I was covering. And that is, for me, a real no-no. I mean, I want to stand outside, and they had pulled me inside.
Okay, so you tried to not reveal what you were feeling on the air, but what is it that you were feeling when you came up to number 17?
Well, what I was feeling, I mean, it didn't really bother me that I was on the enemies list, although it didn't occur to me that I was important enough in their terms to get on the enemies list. So astonished was the word for it, but much more because I had such a long life in journalism, from print to radio to television and all, that my standards were being violated. I'm supposed to be the observer, the fly on the wall, and suddenly I had to say my own name as part of the story that I was covering, and somehow the electrifying effect of having to deal with that professional problem overcame everything else.
Were you afraid you'd be taken off the beat?
We then said, in packaging it for the CBS Evening News, we just consulted and said, you better assign this part of the story to somebody else to do. I obviously can't do it. And that was obviously true.
So what were you doing on the list?
Well, it's very hard to say what I was doing on a list. I had some general idea. Mind you, the list was drawn up in 1971. That's to say, the list was a pre-Watergate list. A lot of things were dug up during the Watergate investigation from the past. So the question was, what was it they had against me in 1971? Well, I had done a couple of stories in 1971 on CBS, which I know ruffled their feathers a little bit. I had reported that President Nixon had serious reservations about going ahead with the anti-ballistic missile system, which he had inherited from previous administrations, and since they were trying to get new appropriation for it, his reservations didn't ring very well and all, and they got very angry with me about that. There was also the fact that President Nixon made a speech in New York to a Catholic audience, to the Knights of Columbus, promising that he would find ways of giving federal help to parochial schools, although the Supreme Court had just come out with a decision saying that it was unconstitutional. And in analyzing what the meaning of the speech was, I'd have been asked by CBS to report what was it they were planning to do. And my inquiries indicated they weren't planning to do anything, and there wasn't anything they could do. And so I went on the air after a cut of Nixon getting wonderful applause from the Knights of Columbus, New York, and came right on and said, yeah, that's what he said, but we find no evidence that there is anything they're going to do or can do, and it is all simply political rhetoric. Well, that speech had been written by Pat Buchanan, and he didn't take very kindly to that. And as we subsequently discovered from many, many investigations, he then called President Nixon, who was traveling, and Nixon had somebody called J. Edgar Hoover. And that was how the FBI investigation of me started. But in 1971, I was simply covering whole aspects of what the Nixon administration was doing, which had to do with civil rights and had to do with housing and urban problems and all. And when I found that they were making promises and not keeping them, I had no hesitation in reporting that. And I guess no president likes it, but no president before has ever reacted so violently to it.
Some people who made it onto that enemies list considered it a badge of honor, did you?
Oh, yes. Well, a badge of honor. It turned out to be very useful. First of all, by the time I was aware of the enemies list, I knew nothing ever was going to happen about it, although I had been audited rather curiously by the IRS. But yes, it was. There were buttons handed out by some well-meaning people that read Dean's List. And after a while, I found it was increasing my invitations to dinner parties that I like to go to and adding to my lecture fee. So, you know, as I recall, you know.
Boy, did they do you a favor.
Yeah, did they do me. And some of my colleagues who were not on the enemies list came to be a little resentful. Dan Rather, who had been covering the White House then, somehow didn't make it on the enemies list, and he didn't like that at all.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Shore, NPR senior news analyst, and he's also narrating a five-part documentary series on Watergate that begins this Sunday on the Discovery Channel. Now, President Nixon also ordered an FBI investigation of you on the pretext that you were in line for a top federal job. So, of course, they had to investigate you. How did you find out about this investigation?
Well, very simply. He had Haldeman have his assistant, Larry Higby, call J. Edgar Hoover and simply say, the boss, the president, wants to have some background stuff on correspondent named Daniel Shore. And apparently Hoover misunderstood, either really misunderstood or maybe mischievously chose to misunderstand. The word background is used by the FBI, is commonly used for background checks on people who are going to be nominated to presidential positions, presidential appointments. And so there apparently was some misunderstanding, with the result that the investigation that was ordered by Hoover was basically a wide-open investigation in which agents called up my employer, called up members of my family, and indeed sent an FBI agent up to CBS to interview me. And when I said, what is this all about? He said, presumably you know, these are usually done for pre-appointment investigations. I said, but nobody's offered me anything. When the word got back that this had happened, they quickly and rather precipitously called off the investigation and then began to have a damage control meeting as to what to do when the story came out. And so all those wonderful people, Ron Ziegler and Chuck Colson, all got together and they said, well, there's the only thing we can do is to say that he was under consideration for a job, however preposterous that may seem, and actually identify a job.
What job did they come up with for
it? It was a public relations person for the Council on Environmental Quality, which was then headed by Russell Train, who a long time later apologized to me profusely because he knew that he had been used for that purpose.
You must have been so amused thinking of the Nixon administration hiring you for a PR job.
Well, I didn't believe it, of course.
Yeah, no,
I never believed it, but they, with a straight face, they put out that story. And then in the end, what happened was that they had to testify under oath about it before the Senate Watergate Committee and then again before the House Judiciary Committee, which was holding impeachment hearings. And they had to confess that the purpose of the investigation of me was quite adverse and that they had tried to cover it up. And all of that was confessed. And in the end, when the Judiciary Committee approved three articles of impeachment against Nixon, Article 2 was called abuse of power, and under that was listed the FBI investigation of me. So I became a part of the history of the impeachment of Nixon in that very odd way. You want me to tell you how that story ended many
sure,
years later?
Yeah, sure.
Well, the interesting thing was that in the months before his death, Nixon and I had some kind of a reconciliation of sorts. I found myself being invited to small dinners where Nixon was giving briefings on his trips to the former Soviet Union. And at one of these, the first of these dinners, I was wondering if he remembered who I was or why I was being invited, and unable to resist that temptation, at the end of dinner, I went up to Nixon and I said, Mr. Nixon, I'm not sure you will remember me, but... And he interrupted me and he said, oh, sure, Dan, sure. Damn near hired you once.
Did Did he believe that?
No, he didn't believe that. That was his little joking way of trying to make up. I don't know. It was a quip. He said it with a smile. And I'm sure he had worked it out in his mind that he was going to say it to me. But the fact of the matter was he wanted to be forgiven or forgotten or whatever. And I found it not difficult to do that.
Why did you find it not difficult to do that?
Well, for one thing, because I had a certain amount of respect for his 20-year campaign after resignation to try to rehabilitate himself. He was a man who had done many comebacks, and I thought the toughest comeback of all was running for ex-president. And I had to respect that, and because, he who is without blemish should be casting stones around. I consider life too short to have grudges, retain grudges. And furthermore, I found him interesting. And he invited me to join a foreign policy institute that he wanted to plan in Washington, which apparently is going to go ahead. And as far as I'm concerned, anywhere I can go and talk to people who know something and help me in my work, well, why not? That was 20-odd years ago, and there's statute of limitations on all things.
Did you get your Freedom of Information Act files?
Yes, I did. I got my FBI file on a Freedom of Information application and found out step by step what had happened. What I also found out is that the FBI is not a very efficient organization. The first message in the file had to do with Hoover saying that giving orders for an expedite investigation that the White House wanted of me, and then added at the end that I was last identified as CBS correspondent in Germany, according to Who's Who. And so they were sending a message to the FBI representative at the American Embassy in Bonn. This, mind you, was 5 years after I had come back from Germany and had been on CBS television almost every night, and the FBI had no way to look me up except in Who's Who, an outdated Who's Who at that, which listed me as correspondent in Germany. And then they went ahead.
My guest is NPR senior news analyst Daniel Schorr. He narrates a documentary series about Watergate that begins Sunday on the Discovery Channel. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Daniel Schorr is my guest. August 8th is the 20th anniversary of Nixon's resignation from the presidency, and we're talking about what it was like to cover the Watergate story. You were working for CBS, mm-hmm. covering the story for mm-hmm. them. What was it like being a TV reporter covering Watergate? I mean, this really was the kind of story that required so much detailed investigative work. It wasn't a pictures kind of story.
That's a very perceptive question. For a long time, it was a newspaper story, a Washington Post story, but also New York Times, LA Times carried elements of it. And it was very, very tough for a while because I was not keeping up with the newspapers, which were on the whole doing a better job. Indeed, the first big thing that we did, I had a couple of small scoops of one kind or another, but not really very significant compared to the developing story. And in fact, probably the greatest contribution we made in the early days, that is before the 72 election, was a decision to assemble all the known material, everything that had been in newspapers elsewhere, and put on a very long two-part series on the CBS Evening News of about 9, 10, 11 minutes each. And we didn't claim that we were original on it, but we did claim to be telling the country what a lot of Washington Post readers knew, but the country didn't. And so that became our contribution, enough of a contribution, in fact, so that the White House, Chuck Colson, called Bill Paley, the head of CBS, and threatened him with loss of television stations and so on if he didn't stop doing this Watergate series.
And what was the response at CBS?
Well, alas, the response of Bill Paley was, the first piece had already been on a Friday night, and they billboarded the next big piece was Monday, and then it didn't go on Monday, and it went on Tuesday considerably truncated on the orders, personal orders of Bill Paley.
Well, you must have been pretty angry about that.
Yes, indeed. We were all angry about that. I mean, this was not just myself. We all, it was a cooperative effort involving everybody in the Washington Bureau. And we were furious, yes. Particularly furious because CBS had been so good on Watergate up until that point and then sort of cracked at a crucial moment.
Did you ever worry about self-censorship, that you would not say things because of the damage that would be done to your reputation from the White House or the hurt that could come to your network because of a report?
I maybe should have worried about, a little more about it. Maybe I would not have been on the enemy's list or investigated by the FBI or called up and bawled out on midnight one night by President Johnson and once by President Kennedy. Maybe I should have paid more attention to the fact that these people don't really like being criticized that way, but I didn't. But my problems were very rarely with the government other than with Nixon. Problems tend to be more within your own organization. Imagine on one occasion when I came back after Nixon had resigned, I went on vacation, came back, and then a new story was starting. Revelations were starting to be made about the CIA and what it had been up to. And so I was assigned what I call the Son of Watergate correspondent job, and that was covering the investigations of the CIA. Well, just imagine, in the course of following the investigation by Congress of the CIA, there came a story that Bill Paley, had in the 1950s done a favor for his friends at the CIA, allowing them to use CBS cover for CIA agents. Unthinkable thing to do, and very endangering to CBS correspondents everywhere. I had the job of getting that on the CBS Evening News, and I did.
How'd you do it?
Well, I told them that the story was in the hands of the New York Times, and that it was going to be in the papers tomorrow anyway, and isn't it better if we break our own story and convince the Cronkite Show Evening News people to do it? And there it was, with a picture of Paley and my reporting and giving his denial and all the rest of it. Later on, when I got into terrible trouble with CBS, Bill Sapphire wrote in the New York Times that my real trouble had been by revealing Paley's secret of his CIA connections, that he had never forgiven me for that. That may be true.
Some people who were considered Nixon's enemies and who found that their phones were tapped or on the enemies list became very paranoid, I think, after that. You know, wondering, well, who's out to get me now? Who's tapping my phone now? Really, in a lot of ways, that was a very paranoid period because a lot of people were afraid that they were being followed by the FBI, even if they weren't. I'm wondering if you ever felt that there was a kind of permanent after effect on you of knowing that you really were being investigated by the FBI and you really were on a president's enemies list.
Well, no, because for one thing, it was so uniquely Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
And understand that it was in 1973 that we were finding out what had happened in 1971,
mm-hmm.
which meant that by the time we were finding it out, Nixon was already on the ropes. And one just simply tied that to that era. And when, you know, when President Ford took over and said, that's the end of our national nightmare, we were all ready to believe that we would go back to some kind of normalcy, that we'd been through some nightmare, and I guess that was how we felt.
Daniel Shore is NPR's senior news analyst. We'll talk more about Watergate and his career as a journalist in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our conversation with NPR senior news analyst Daniel Schorr about Watergate. Next Monday is the 20th anniversary of Nixon's resignation from office. And we'll talk with Schorr about his childhood in New York and his early career as a journalist. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new reissue of the now defunct and, he says, underrated Irish punk band, The Undertones. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Bosnian Serb Self-Declared Assembly has voted to hold a referendum on the latest international peace plan for Bosnia. They took a separate vote as well, and they repeated their rejection of the plan to divide Bosnia roughly evenly between them and their Muslim Croat enemies. This is the third time the Bosnian Serbs have rejected the plan. They have come under intense pressure from neighboring Serbia to accept it. President Clinton has called on Congress to adopt a health care reform plan quickly. He's going to talk about the matter tonight in a nationally televised press conference. UPI's Bill Small has this report.
Mr. Clinton warmed up for his primetime news conference by welcoming to the South Lawn some 600 of those who rode the Health Security Express buses into Washington. The president telling his enthusiastic audience that, difficult though it may be, it's time for Congress to act on health care reform.
We didn't say, vote for me in a representative form of government, and I will make all the necessary decisions to solve the problems of the country, except those that are difficult, controversial, and make people mad. Right.
First Lady Hillary Clinton called it a critical moment for health care reform, but said she's optimistic that a bill will be approved. Bill Small at the White House.
The space station has been funded again by the Senate. The lawmakers killed an amendment today that would have withdrawn the station's money. Opponents of the space station had pushed for the cut. They say the General Accounting Office has found Russian participation might actually increase the program's cost instead of saving money. An Amtrak train with 320 passengers aboard derailed near Batavia, New York early today. No deaths were reported, but at least 96 passengers were injured. Mark Scott of member station WBFO reports.
Amtrak's Lakeshore Limited en route from New York City to Chicago derailed around 3:45 this morning. 9 of the 16 cars fell off the track, coming to rest at the bottom of a 15-foot embankment. Emergency officials say they have accounted for all of the passengers. The injured were taken to hospitals in Batavia and Buffalo. Passenger David Anderson of Quincy, Massachusetts, said he knew something was wrong just prior to the derailment.
It felt like just before we went off that everything just started to shake. Like the ground was letting go under us, you know. There was a possibility that, you know, maybe something wrong with the track.
Investigators are at the scene trying to determine what caused the derailment. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Scott in Batavia, New York.
The government says its index of leading economic indicators rose 0.2% in June. Analysts say the gain was a little bigger than expected, and it shows the economy is growing at a moderate pace. Stock prices closed mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 3.5 points to end the day at 3,792. On the broader market, advances led declines by a small margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. In Nigeria, at least 3 people have been killed in clashes between police and pro-democracy demonstrators in the city of Lagos. NPR Suni Khalid reports.
A general strike called by the Nigerian Labor Congress brought commerce and traffic in the country's largest city, Lagos, to a halt. The strike was called by the 3.5 million member Congress to dramatize their demands that Nigeria's military government free all political prisoners and surrender power to a democratic government. Nigeria's most prominent political prisoner, Tycoon Masoud Abiola, is on trial for treason. Abiola, the apparent winner of last year's annulled presidential elections, was arrested 2 months ago after declaring himself president in defiance of Nigeria's military ruler, General Sani Abacha. Since then, strikes and riots by pro-democracy groups have crippled Nigeria's ailing economy, especially a five-week strike by oil workers. Oil industry analysts in London say that oil production in Nigeria has already fallen by a third and could be headed for further reductions if the strikes spread. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
United Nations aid workers in Zaire say it will take a massive effort to help Rwandan refugees get home. A spokesman for the UN's High Commissioner for Refugees says no matter how bad the camps are, most of the refugees won't leave. Spokesman Ray Wilkinson says about 1 million Rwandans are crowded into the Zairean camps. He says the number of cholera deaths is down, but the new fear is dysentery. Wilkinson says that could send the death toll skyrocketing. Some 19 big fires are still raging in 8 western states. A detachment of Marines has teamed up with fire crews in Washington State to battle blazes. Other crews are putting out 2 major fires near Leavenworth. There are 6 other major blazes around Washington, and weather forecasters warn thunderstorms could spark new fires. Meanwhile, 1,300 Army soldiers from Fort Hood, Texas, are going to Idaho and Montana today. They will help put out major fires there. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Daniel Schorr, NPR's senior news analyst. He's the narrator of a 5-part documentary on Watergate that begins Sunday on the Discovery Channel. Schorr covered Watergate for CBS TV and became part of the story when he appeared on Nixon's enemies list. This is a good time to consider Nixon's legacy in the light of his death earlier this year and the 20th anniversary of his resignation from office, which is next Monday. After watching hours of Watergate footage for the TV series and working on a Watergate article for the Washington Post, Dan Schorr says he has one new perception about Nixon.
The paranoia with which we've associated with President Nixon was a paranoia of a rather special sort. He not only lied to the country, he lied to himself. He came to believe some of his delusions and acted on those delusions because to him they were true. As for example, the breaking into Watergate, it turns out, was not to get something on Larry O'Brien, but because Larry O'Brien had been a consultant to Howard Hughes, and Nixon feared that O'Brien had something on him, namely knowing about the $100,000 illegal contribution that had been made through Nixon's friend B.B. Rebozo and kept in a Key Biscayne bank as a kind of a nest egg for President Nixon, and the fear that Larry O'Brien was going to bust that story open at the wrong time in the campaign, and they had to break in and find out what it was that Larry O'Brien might have. P.S., Larry O'Brien, who died in 1990, had said before he died that he never knew about the illegal contribution, and that if he had known about it, they would not have to break into his office to get it. He would have told the whole world. Well, there were things like that. There were things where the worst thing that happened to Nixon is that he believed his own paranoid theories.
Daniel Schorr, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your early years, your coming of age, and your start in journalism. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the neighborhood you grew up in.
Well, I grew up in the Bronx in a semi-poor but respectable neighborhood. From a very early age, as far as I can even remember, journalism was all I wanted to do. And I remember the first money I earned from journalism when I was about 13 years old. We lived on the ground floor of a tenement. And one day I heard a big plop outside the window and looked out the window, and lying there was somebody who had fallen or jumped off the roof. So cool as a reporter ought to be, I waited for police to arrive, found out what I could, and called the local newspaper, which paid $5 for news tips, and dictated a story. And that was really, in a sense, a benchmark for what was to be my career, in that if you can see something which might make you, which might affect you, and find yourself not affected except wanting to know what it's all about so you can explain it to other people, I think that's the basis of a journalistic career. It is removing yourself from drama so you can describe the drama.
Well, you know, exactly. I mean, I'm thinking how old were you when this happened?
13.
Okay, a lot of 13-year-olds would have been plagued by nightmares after seeing somebody fall to their
right.
death, or would, you know, nowadays need therapy. And instead, you're doing investigative work and calling in the story.
Well, right. And And that's how I've tried to have it be through most of my life, although people sometimes don't let it be that way. I got dragged into my Watergate story when I later on covered the CIA story. In the end, I found myself being threatened with a jail term for contempt of Congress when they demanded that I reveal where I got the report, a congressional report, which the House of Representatives had voted to suppress.
And parenthetically, I'll put in, that's had a lot to do with your falling out with CBS.
And that had a lot to do with my falling out with CBS, which it did not wish in 1976, when cable television was first beginning to come on. CBS did not want to be placed in an adversary position to Congress, which was beginning to pass legislation on that. So they were horrified to see me as a symbol of a confrontation between CBS and Congress, and they didn't like that.
Well, back to Dan Shore, the early years. I know your father died when you were young, and you had to go to work at an early age. What kind of jobs did you do when you were young?
Well, I delivered newspapers, which maybe was one way of approaching journalism. I sold magazines, the Saturday Evening Post and so on. I carried on a little bit. I had a selling printing for a mail order house in Chicago, went around offering people low prices on stationery and business cards and so on, and that kind of thing, earning as much money as I could because we really needed it. My mother, widowed, was working in the needle trades in New York. My younger brother had been very ill during most of his early life. And so money was really very important. I'm talking about Depression years. I'm talking about 1929 and 30, 31. And in the end, I managed to get into City College, which was free, or I would not have gone to college at all.
Were your parents immigrants?
Yes.
Were they born? So did they speak English well?
No. Well, I really don't remember how well my father spoke English, because I was about 5 when he died, and I have very little memory of that. My mother spoke with an accent for all of her life, although she pretty well educated herself and read a great deal and was very literate. But that accent remains. I guess maybe this is the time even to reveal that our name when my parents arrived in New York from Russia was not even Shore. It was a different name. My father gave his name on arrival. The officer said, "What's your name?" And my father gave it. The name was Chornomorets, which in Russian means Black Sea. And the immigration officer asked for it a couple of times, so my mother told me, and unable to write it down, write down Shore, S-C-H-O-R-R, and said, "Mr. Shore, welcome to America."
How did your parents feel about the name change? Did your mother care?
Well, I don't think so. Understand, the process of Americanization involved a great deal of casting off old things and acquiring America all of a sudden. And so while I don't think my parents would have voluntarily on their own changed their name, and if they hadn't, I could just see myself with how many sign-offs, "This is Daniel Chornomorets," in Moscow or whatever, I think they accepted it as a part of the price of admission into this wonderful country.
My guest is Daniel Shore, NPR senior news analyst. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Daniel Shore. Did you feel, in a way, that you had to be a journalist for your mother? A lot of times when a kid is growing up who was born in America, sometimes that kid has to translate not only the language but a lot of the culture for the parent.
Well, that's right. And journalism didn't transfer very well into their culture. When my mother asked me at about 13, 14 what I wanted to be, and I said a journalist, she looked at me very disapprovingly. "So you don't want something like lawyer or doctor with a degree, which is what Jewish kids did. You know, lawyer, doctor, those were the two things. And journalists didn't carry a degree. And in fact, I recall my mother saying to me, journalist, isn't that a little bit like show business? at that time.
Little did she know.
Little did she know. But I said yes, and she came to it. She came to accept it. She came actually to be a little proud of it. She came to understand that journalism was A, respectable, and B, that you can make a living at it, more important.
So what did you read when you were young that made you so excited by the idea of journalism?
I'm not sure I needed to read anything to be excited by the idea of journalism. It was just somewhere in my blood or in my genes. I guess we don't use those scientific words anymore. But, for example, when I went to Hebrew school, I started a newspaper in the Hebrew school, a monthly paper. When I went to high school, DeWitt Clinton High School, I worked on the Clinton News. When I went to City College, I worked on the City College campus. It seemed that wherever I went, even in my early schooling, that journalism had to be a part of it. And I don't ever recall it being even a conscious choice of any kind. There was never any profession that I rejected. I just was a journalist.
You know, this innate feeling that it was your job to detach yourself from what was happening and describe it, did that apply to very emotional things that were happening to you, too? Did you find yourself trying to distance yourself from that and describe it as well?
Well, that's interesting. That's interesting. It maybe gets us deeper into psyche than I really planned to go. But since you ask, I've wondered myself about it. I've wondered myself about this dispassionate, disinterested view that I have of world and dramatic events and sometimes tragic events. And wonder whether, unable to come to terms with the death of my father when I was very young, that I was able then to deal with my father's death by removing myself from it, and thus learned to remove myself from a great many painful things.
I think it was in 1953 that you were recruited by Edward R. Murrow for the CBS news team. I mean, this is the most celebrated news team in television history. What was it like for you? Did it feel worthy of the celebration?
Well, that was interesting, too. I had that. This is 1953, and I was working in Western Europe, living in Holland, working in Western Europe as a stringer for various New York Times, for Time magazine, and for CBS. And in 1953, February, there was an enormous storm that broke the dikes, something that hadn't happened in hundreds of years, broke the dikes in southern Holland. A large part of the country was devastated by a flood. And I did some fairly dramatic reporting on that for CBS as well as for others. And Murrow was impressed. He sent a cable, which read, "Would you at all consider... Would you at all consider joining the staff of CBS with an initial assignment in Washington?" And so then I went to work for CBS, but I'll tell you, with some reservations. Those were the early days when a newspaper person thought of radio and television as not really quite journalism, but somewhere closer to show business. And I sort of worried a little bit about that, but I thought I would try it and see if it was possible to do. I must say that in the first days in Washington, Scotty Reston, a friend of mine in the New York Times, every once in a while would say to me, "Have you had enough?" And I said, "No, Scotty, maybe soon, but not yet," as though I was still giving it a trial. Well, trial at CBS lasted for 25 years, and I went open the Moscow Bureau for CBS and came back and joined that group of people that Murrow would have at the end of the year discussing the affairs of the world. People revered to me, like Alex Kendrick and Howard Smith and David Schoendren, who maybe I revered less but respected all the same. And here was I feeling that I was really in very, very big and important company. And I can remember the first time I appeared on that show. I'd just come back from Moscow and appeared on this ad-lib show of an hour and a half. And when we just finished taping it, I was sitting there at the Circle. Murrow sort of walked over and looked at me. He's a very understated man. Walked over and looked at me and said, "Sure, you'll do."
Did that feel really good?
That felt very, very good.
When you were covering the Soviet Union for CBS. You were eventually thrown out of the country. I think this is in 1957.
Right.
And you were denounced by Pravda as a provocateur
right.
and adventurer. And I'm not sure I know what it means to be denounced as an adventurer.
Well, those are words which have sort of better meaning in Russian than they have in England, in English. It is sort of a synonym for provocateur, someone who's trying to stir up trouble. I had indeed made trouble. They had official censorship then. You had to submit your scripts, newspaper stories, you'd submit them and wait for them to come back, with sometimes things excised. Radio scripts, you had to sort of submit and wait until they came back before you could broadcast them, sometimes missing your circuit, which wasn't wonderful. And that would irritate me, and at times when that would happen, I would go in and try to read my script anyway. Sometimes I'd read a script where a paragraph had been taken out, and I was particularly fond of that paragraph, so I'd read it anyway. And then I was warned that I was violating censorship. And I said, well, listen, I don't believe in censorship. And so that became a problem for them. And in the end, they would do things like having me arrested briefly on some trumped-up thing by the KGB as a warning, and then eventually decided enough was enough, in spite of the fact that I'd made history in the Soviet Union by doing the first ever television interview with a Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev. And so I thought maybe that would give me a little bit of protection. In the end, it didn't. In the end, when the KGB was mad at me, not even being identified with Khrushchev helped.
Through all your career as a reporter, you tried to keep yourself out of the story. And as an analyst, I mean, your thoughts are the story. Your analysis is the story.
But not my emotions.
But not your emotions. Right, right.
And I think that to sort of anticipate your question, but if I haven't anticipated right, you'll tell me. I think that news analysis goes along with objective journalism. Mm-hmm. As long as you say the way you think things are instead of the way you want things to be. And I think that the information has become simply altogether too complex for people to be able to understand without some help from people with backgrounds. So I don't regard news analysis on NPR or anywhere as being different from what I consider to be the objective journalism, which has been my idol.
So in other words, you're saying that you see analysis as being in part about synthesis so that to help people make sense of a lot of facts and put them in some
kind
of context?
That's right. In the CNN age, in the age of CNN, where things are brought to you live, you can see happening everything that's happening and have everything there except understanding what it means. And I think the more live news people get, the more they need help in understanding it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Daniel Schorr is NPR's senior news analyst. He's the narrator of a 5-part documentary series about Watergate that begins Sunday on the Discovery Channel. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We have lots of stories about crime today on the program. An interview with Attorney General Janet Reno about the crime bill, what it might accomplish. Also, we'll be hearing a story on the prison business and what happens to people who build prisons when the crime rate goes up. Business, as you might imagine, is good for them. Also, news today of Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen's appearance before the Whitewater Committee. And we'll also be hearing from a cartoonist who tried to call up lots of the 800 numbers suggested by the O.J. Simpson case.
Okay. Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Undertones emerged from the punk rock scene of the late 70s with a bright, crisp sound and a distinctive lead singer named Fergal Sharkey. This Irish group disbanded in 1983. Rykodisc has recently reissued all 4 of their albums. Rock critic Ken Tucker salutes the Undertones as an underrated band. It's not the urgent wanting some attention. Our teenage dreams, they're surely worth a mention. The Sears more songs about chocolate and girls. It's not so easy, knowing they'll be heard. A lot less time, but a lot more care. So here's more songs.
The chorus of that song goes, "Here's more songs about chocolate and girls. It's not so easy knowing they'll be heard." That's the sort of thing the Undertones did best, capturing an adolescent self-consciousness that even extended to thinking about all the people who might be listening to their music. When the Undertones started out, they were teenagers in Derry, Northern Ireland. Influenced by punk rock's speed and Anyone Can Do It spirit, the Undertones had from the very start a unique sound in the scratchy tenor voice of Fergal Sharkey. The Undertones were intent on never growing up. Just look at their song titles. Boys Will Be Boys, The Way Girls Talk, Girls That Don't Talk, and even a cover of the Chocolate Watch Band's Let's Talk About Girls. Well, that's just about all the Undertones ever did. When, given their hometown, some critics wondered why they never wrote about Ireland's troubles, they responded with a song called It's Going to Happen, a hopelessly vague attempt to be political. No, the Undertones were always best when they stayed within their own little world, ogling girls and bad-mouthing stuck-up kids like the one in My Perfect Cousin. Now I've got a cousin called Kevin. He's sure to go to heaven. Always spotless, clean and neat. As smooth as you'll get him. He's got a fur-lined sheepskin jacket. My ma said they cost a packet. She won't even let me explain that me and Kevin were just not the same. Rykodisc has four Undertones releases, all of them containing bonus tracks of previously unreleased songs. If I was on a budget, however, I'd just get the one that's clearly the best, most coherent album they made, Hypnotized, from 1980. All the music I'm playing in this review is from that disc, and it sums up everything that made the Undertones a great little band.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker and Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Abby Beshkin. I'm Terry Gross. Still watching your dance. My world had stopped when I saw your eyes on me. HYP, I'm hypnotized. HYP, I'm hypnotized. HYP.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the Israel-Jordan Pact. We talk with New York Times reporter Thomas Friedman about the implications for each country and for Syria, which is now the only major party to the Arab-Israeli conflict that has not reconciled with Israel. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.